I'm John Krall. Today on this special edition of No Limits, we will talk with retiring Indiana Chief Justice Randall T. Shepard. Shepard has served as Chief Justice of the state's highest court for 25 years, longer than anyone else in Indiana history. He has served with five different governors. He has overseen the transformation of the Supreme Court from being a court clogged with mandatory criminal appeals to being one that is the primary interpreter of the meaning and application of Indiana laws. A lot of history happened on Randall Shepard's watch. We will talk about all of this with the Chief Justice himself and you. Please join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and executive editor of thestatehousefile.com. This is a special edition of No Limits. We're glad to have you here. We are talking today with Indiana Chief Justice Randall Shepard. Chief Justice Shepard, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
It's good to have you here. We're going to be talking with Chief Justice Shepard for the whole hour. We would invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, 25 years on the bench, Chief Justice Shepard. Actually, 27 years.
Yes.
27 years and 25 years as Chief Justice. What prompted the decision to retire now?
I think a rather natural consideration. My term as chief is in 5-year increments. Every time you come around to that kind of a demarcation, you ask yourself whether you want to keep doing this or would you be interested in doing something else. And five times, or I've decided, yes, that sounded like a good place to be. And this time, I think the best thing was for a change for me and for the institution.
Well,
nothing very magical about
It's a deep. Are you a checklist kind of guy? I mean, when you look at the things
that
you
accomplish. I wish I was, but I'd I'd be more efficient if I were. But I don't usually have a checklist.
Well, I guess where I'm going with this, I'm wondering, since this is sort of a legacy look back, that having spent 25 years on the court, and I think most observers would say that you were part of transforming the Indiana Supreme Court in a significant way, I'd like to go back a little bit and say, you know, when you started the first time, you said yes to this opportunity to serve. Did you have goals set for what you wanted your tenure to be? And could you talk a little bit about what those goals were? And then we'll talk some about, you know, how many of them you managed to click off the list that apparently you don't keep.
Well, maybe I'd describe that in two somewhat global ways. The first and most important thing that had to happen at the Indiana Supreme Court was to create it as a court where people's cases got heard by the court or not heard based on the kind of issue they brought, the kind of interest they brought, whether this was something that affected a lot of people or only a few, whether it was a new question of law. And in 1985, 86, 87, the court had come a place where pretty much only people appealing criminal cases could get onto the court's docket. The first full year I was there, only 7% of all appeals heard by the Indiana Supreme Court included everything other than criminal work, so that if you had a child custody question or a contract dispute or a banking issue or a personal injury claim, all of those things that are the part of daily life got squeezed into that 7%, and you competed and usually lost.
And just to make sure our listeners understand, why is it that only 7% of the court's load? There was an institutional thing there.
The last time the state constitution had been revised on this question, a provision had been enacted that said that if you were a criminal defendant who had more than 10 years sentence, you had an automatic right of direct appeal to the Supreme Court, and the court had to hear your case. Now, people who get more than 10 years in prison are entitled to careful attention. They've mm-hmm. lost their liberty. Mm-hmm. But it meant that all the rest of society couldn't get their important cases heard. So the very first and most important sort of predicate thing that had to happen was to persuade the legislature and then the public in general to amend the state constitution so that the court could look across all of the cases that were being brought and decide which ones needed the most urgent attention. So that was sort of the first big thing that had to happen. And then the second thing, this is again describing it at this is slightly global level, mm-hmm. was to find ways to help improve and to make just as good as we can make it the kind of justice people get in the county courthouses, because that's where most people get their cases heard. Mm-hmm. They don't get to the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals or the tax court. They're heard in the courthouses, in the city-county building. And since then, since 1990, we've vastly improved, I think, the work we do to support court staff and trial judges and help them do their best at handling the roughly 2 million cases a year that they have to work their way through.
And, you know, in terms of the global thing, you wanted to make the court then or help the court become a more deliberative body.
Yes, that's a good way of describing that first one.
Yeah, much more, much less reactive mm-hmm. to, you know, responding to those mandatory appeals. Did you set out to try to make it much more, you know, a Supreme Court in the way we think of the U.S. Supreme Court, an interpreter of laws and an interpreter of really how the Constitution itself should be interpreted?
Absolutely. I didn't regard this as being a particularly fancy idea. it was almost self-evident. The court had become a place where work as hard as they did. They were still, it was still a kind of a widget factory, just because of the nature of the enterprise. And if it was going to have a chance to have a broader point of view, you had to give it the ability to pick out the ones that really affected lots of people or raised new constitutional questions. And that became a predicate for a lot of other things that have happened.
It sounds now like it was, you know, common sense that there was an inevitability to it. But as you know probably better than anyone, there was a heck of a fight that went on over mm-hmm. some of these ideas and where mm-hmm. the Supreme Court should be. And you got caught up in that and in ways became a target to some degree. There were, you know, in addition to your performance on the court, they focused on your personal life and mm-hmm. and all sorts of stuff. Why was there so much pushback on something that now seems so, to use your term, self-evident?
Well, I suppose you might say this new kid showed up. I mean, I was 38 when I was 38 when I arrived, and I think the next youngest member was 55, and the others were all in their 60s. And I, looking back on it, I could imagine thinking that this kid who arrived was kind of the skunk at the garden party. although I would say there was a lot of sympathy for the kind of changes that needed to be made, and the period of unpleasantness was relatively brief. I'd be my judgment, and that by and large, over time, there was a lot of agreement and collaboration on where we needed to head.
How difficult was it for you to work through that period at the time? I would think, as you say, you were a relatively young man still mm-hmm. at that point with mm-hmm. not that much experience, I would gather, being the subject of statewide attention.
Well, I'll
and
tell
what
you
did
one,
you learn yeah. from the experience? What did you learn from
yeah,
the
Yeah, well, I'll tell you one of the first things I learned, fortunately not the hard way, was that the things I said usually got repeated or rebroadcast in ways that were beyond my previous experience. I obviously had experience in public office, so I understood that you were usually quotable. But I had the experience one day of speaking at the Abraham Lincoln event down in Rockport, and a radio reporter from a local radio station came to ask me a series of questions, fairly straightforward, nothing particularly dramatic. And when I'd come back to Indianapolis, I woke up the next morning and heard her interviewing me on WFYI.
Well, we were making news even back.
Well, that's right, and I hadn't made the connection between speaking to someone standing near Nancy Hanks Lincoln's grave and being broadcast statewide. As I say, I learned that lesson at low cost, I'm happy to say, but it helped me recalibrate where I was and what I needed to be about.
We are talking with Chief Justice Randall Shepard here on No Limits today. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to talk a little bit before we get into sort of more the court focus on the man a little bit. When you were going through school, I mean, was being a judge something that you always aspired to?
No, it's something I never conceived of, actually. I'd always had an interest in being a lawyer. As a high school student, there were three things that I would tell people I was interested in. One was being a lawyer, one was the Foreign Service, and the third was journalism. Okay. And I still take an interest in international matters. My wife and I travel a fair amount. I've visited about 30 countries and hope to see some more. And I'm very interested in the news business and how people receive news and how the business is being transformed and how the platforms are changing is a matter of great interest to me. And that interest I'm able to use some in my work at the court. But being a judge is sort of the last, I wouldn't say it was the last thing. It just wasn't there. I just didn't imagine it. I was about 33 when this happened. A judge mm-hmm. on the court in Evansville retired, somewhat surprisingly, and mm-hmm. A friend of mine said to me, "Are you going to apply for this opening?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, you ought to. Why is that?" And then we proceeded to have a conversation sitting out on the front steps of a friend's house in downtown Evansville. And my friend Ann is the one who talked me into this. And she said, "Now, if you don't like it, you don't have to stay forever. You can stay a year or two." But she said, "I think you'd do this all right. And you ought to." So on really bad days, I would call Ann up and complain to her about having been so persuasive. But no, that was largely a matter of, preparation and accident.
Well, and obviously, you'd prepared to be a lawyer, so there was a deliberate choice there. But it sounds like being a judge was more circumstance and opportunity to some degree than anything else. Mm-hmm. What is it, though, that made you stay? What was it about the job that you found so appealing for the work?
Well, in some ways, it's what I'll say is lawyers would experience as well, and that is it's a remarkable combination. As an experience, it's a remarkable combination of the structure of law and the drama of human life. That you're called upon somehow to ask questions about which we have laws, like custody laws or laws of contract. You ask them at a moment when there's nothing abstract about it. It's what happens to Jim and Jane, and how do we account for this personal injury that's just been sustained, and the experience of interacting with people at some moment that's very important in their lives, and doing that all under a sort of a structured regimen where you think you can give consistent and fair answers is really a remarkable privilege.
And are you going to miss that, do you think, or is that?
Yes, I think so. I think so.
You're staying on a little bit. I know you're officially your last day was yesterday, if I'm not mistaken.
Yesterday was the 25th anniversary of my becoming chief, but I won't actually leave the court for another couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's not, and I should say it's sort of a technical, it's because you're the longest serving or most senior
right.
justice. Okay. It's not that you're in danger of becoming the Brett Favre of the Indiana judicial system.
This man, no decency. He is leaving. Yes.
We are talking today with Indiana Chief Justice Randall Shepard on the event of his retirement. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits, the special edition of No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com. We're talking today with Chief Justice Randall Shepard, who is retiring after 25 years serving as the Chief Justice. He's the longest serving Chief Justice in the state's history. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We talked just before the break about how you'd wanted to transform the court. One of your goals was to transform the court into a more deliberative body, and you were able to do that in part by, you know, helping to persuade the legislature. And I should say in this that his interview, when you announced your retirement, I talked with Attorney General Greg Zeller, who basically said you're Indiana's John Marshall.
Oh, my.
That you were the guy who established the Supreme Court as a co-equal body with the legislature and the executive branch. And in part, he cites that. Now, in terms of once you've transformed it into a deliberative body, where did you want it to go? I mean, what kinds of cases did you want the court to take, and how successful do you think you were at getting it there? Or I know you don't like to talk about it as a singular achievement. The entire court was able in achieving that vision.
Well, I think I didn't really have a kind of case other than the broad field of civil law. Those are the legal problems of most people, and they needed to have better access. And we needed the time to do our best when they brought it in the door. And there are a host of examples, some of which I was able to share with the legislature the last time I gave my report, of instances where, here's a for instance, I was at a conference of chief justices, and the chief justice of Nevada came up to me and said, boy, we were really glad to get your case on gaming. And I said, you've got to be kidding. He said, yes, we had this case in our court, and we spent half an hour debating the decision that Indiana had made. I said, you've got to be kidding. Nevada has forgotten more gaming law. How can that be? And he said, no, you were the only people in the country who'd wrestled with this point. I've now forgotten what exactly the topic was. But that's a sign that we were wrestling with things that mattered. They mattered, obviously, to our litigants, or we wouldn't have heard them in the first place. And they mattered to the institutions in Indiana, but doing it in a way that was sufficiently cogent that it was useful all over the place. And that's a matter of great professional pride, as you can admit. It wasn't my opinion. It was Frank Sullivan's. Great pride to prove that people in Indiana can do high caliber work, given the right time and the right circumstances. And hallelujah.
We are talking with Chief Justice Randall Shepard on the event of his retirement. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Ruth, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks.
Your question, please.
It's really not a question. I just have to say I've been practicing law roughly the same period of time that the justice has been on the court. And I just want to say that watching the trending of the law in Indiana, he has done a remarkable job of making Indiana relevant in terms of law. We are very conservative as a judicial body, as a judicial state, and with a lot of the new things going on in the world, we're more current than other states around us. And I attribute that a lot to Justice Shepard. He has really been forward-looking in terms of making sure Indiana stays on top of email, e-commerce, et cetera. I just wanted to give him an accolade. He's going to be very badly missed.
Is that the, Ruth, while I've got you on the line here real quickly, The effect of this, you mentioned the email and the e-commerce. Are there specific cases or whatever that you can cite as transformational in that regard?
I can't cite specific cases on those issues because it's not my area. I read it. I'm impressed with where we're headed. I can cite cases on things like what we call the impact rule in Indiana and how dramatically he affected that positively for the average citizen who needs recourse, things like that. I'm not going to say specific cases that I might have been involved in, but I just want to say that I have been very pleased how Indiana has become more advanced. The case we were just talking about with gaming law, this court has not been afraid to address concerns that affect all our citizens, and some courts seem to just ignore or dismiss them. So it was more just a unfortunate we're going to lose him because I think he's been very powerful as an advocate for the average citizen.
Thank you very much for the call, Ruth.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, two things here. One, when she made the reference to the impact ruling, could you describe what that is real quickly?
Well, one of the if you think about the normal personal injury case, it is John who gets hit by a vehicle, and the question historically has been: we know that John might be able to sue for the injuries that he's received. Mm-hmm. What about the person who is riding in John's car or someone who is impacted not physically but is in close proximity and is impacted financially or emotionally? And those are hard lines to draw, and they've shifted over time, I think, in ways that are not libertine, but rather sensible and allowing all the people who are affected by them to order their own affairs.
Well, and this raises a point. I mean, to some degree, you talk about changes in circumstances. Do you find much value in the debate in this country about whether one should be a strict constructionist or see constitutions, both state and national, as living documents, or is that really sort of a false divide?
I try not to use that vocabulary just because it's so politicized. But the fact of the matter is, the Constitution purposefully, both the state and the federal Constitution, use words that have broad meaning. Mm-hmm. Unreasonable search and seizure, classic example. Are you coerced to be a witness against yourself? And that you come up against new questions that the framers didn't have, like the use of thermo technology to look inside the house. Depending on the circumstances, is that reasonable or unreasonable? Well, James Madison gave us a principle to work with. Mm-hmm. He didn't know anything about electronics. Mm-hmm. So we start with the words, we start with the principles that were given to us by the authors, both of the state and federal constitution. Then we also read what prior generations have said about it, and now it's our turn. We use that as a way of informing what it is we do under these facts, or what's this new rule in a society that's always changing, and then you come as close as you can.
Well, and I want to sort of continue on the other point that Ruth made, that you know that you were this transformative figure, that clearly there was a drive to change and improve things. Where did that come from? Because as you say, you didn't set out to be a judge. You didn't set out. This was not the career path you imagined as a young person. Where did the will and the drive to be a transformational figure come from?
I guess my answer to that is that we live in a place and a time, and what decent person wouldn't ask himself or herself the question, is the society doing the best job it can to thrive, to accommodate a diverse society, to create an environment where people can live and raise a family and find a job? I mean, if there's something we can do that will improve on one of those, why the world wouldn't you do it? Mm-hmm. Now you're careful about the fact that others have major roles. I mean, most of the work on economic development is done by the legislature. It's done by the governor. There are things judges are the last players on. Mm-hmm. But on the big question, would you just sit there and and say, or if you were in a place where something needed to happen and it was within your bailiwick to do it, well, of course you would. You join with thoughtful people and try to figure out how to improve it.
We've gotten an email question from a listener who wishes to remain anonymous. It says, Mr. Chief Justice, could you envision any scenario where a court challenge to the current constitutional amendment regarding marriage equality, i.e. the right of gay men and lesbians to marry the partner of their choice in Indiana, might prevail? What's your viewpoint regarding allowing referenda to decide what is essentially a civil right? I probably, as a disclosure, should say I was the executive director of what was then the Indiana Civil Liberties Union when we filed suit to challenge Indiana's law, just for the audience to know so that nobody calls and says I'm trying to hide anything. The listener asked a question, though. A constitutional amendment would take it one step further, obviously, because then it becomes part of the founding charter, if it does, in fact, become that. Are there any circumstances that you could see that sort of challenge prevailing?
Well, if the hypothetical is there a way to challenge the constitutionality of a constitutional amendment, I think mostly the answer to that would be no. One tests statutes and regulations and rules and common law against constitutional norms, but not this is, for example, a reason why the existence of the death penalty is not its administration is susceptible to challenge on grounds like equal protection and due process, but those very clauses seem to recognize that there can be such a thing as a death penalty if the public so chooses. So hard to imagine in an environment where there is an amendment actually adopted by the people that a court would use some other section. I frankly haven't thought much at all about that. But
is there any this may take the question a little further than the listener intended. Would there be any internal contradiction within the Constitution that because that would seem to me at least to be the only possible outlet if the constitutional amendment passed, if it contradicts some other part of constitutional law.
There are times when claims are made that one section conflicts with another, and those are very difficult moments.
We are talking about Chief Justice Randall Shepard's tenure on the Indiana Supreme Court here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Gotten a call from a listener named Robert who says, Mr. Chief Justice, what were your greatest achievements in the arena of juvenile justice? What is the one biggest challenge for juvenile justice moving forward? And then he thanks you for your leadership.
Oh, that's very generous. I'll tell you, I saw a piece of that just this morning. There was in the Capitol building an assembly of perhaps 300 or 400 court-appointed special advocates, volunteers, who speak in court on behalf of abused and neglected children, or in some cases, children not in the abuse and neglect system, but elsewhere. There are something like 3,000 volunteers, and an office of the Supreme Court is engaged in helping local enterprises recruit and train and support those volunteers. And they all wore blue shirts this morning. To see them all in one place, not all of them, but a substantial fraction of them, was just uplifting. This is something that existed in the early 80s and now is engaged in just about every county, not every single county, but almost every county in Indiana. There are people who do this work and speak up on behalf of children. It was a remarkable sight to see those men and women come to celebrate what they do and to make it clear that both the Supreme Court and the legislature have helped make that happen, because it takes some money to organize and recruit volunteers. And the legislature has been willing to support that. That plus a series of things that have had to do with juveniles in jail have been very important. Here in Marion County, the number... my colleague, Justice Steve David, is front and center on what is called the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. the overall result of which has been a dramatic dropping of kids who are under lock and key. And the job, of course, is to sort out which ones can be safely and helpfully assisted outside of a detention facility. That change has been very dramatic, and that effort's now going around into some of the other, particularly some of the other urban areas. But 20 years ago, we had a fair number of kids, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, who were in jail with adults. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that anymore, period.
That's a... When you talk about the advocates and all of that, that's something that, you know, when people look at the Supreme Court, they don't necessarily see it as part of the change. What's been the biggest miss story about the Supreme Court in the past 25 years? The thing, something that you can look at, those of you who are inside could say, you know, that was a significant change. And nobody else seemed to notice it.
Well, that's a very... I might have to think longer about it. I'll tell you the first one that came to mind.
Okay.
I'm not sure it's
good.
The answer.
Okay.
But here's the problem. What do you do if you're holding court in Brown County and someone comes to court who only speaks Bulgarian?
Oh.
By the way, most of the people who do that, including most of the people who speak Spanish and come into court, are there legally. This is partly an illegal immigration issue, but most of the people, many people come in speaking only Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
Spanish, the big one, of course.
Yeah.
And when I was a trial judge, of course, you had that happen in almost always only Spanish, and you would call the university or the high school and ask whether the Spanish teacher or the Spanish professor could come. There is no Bulgarian professor, okay?
Yeah.
And the people who do come, how do you know that they really are good at interpreting? So we have put in place a very energetic program to help make that difference out in the courthouses.
We are talking with Chief Justice Randall Shepherd here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello. Chief Justice Shepherd, I want to congratulate you on completing your mission, and I wanted to ask whether, as you make a change now, as the court makes a change to the new administration, whether cases that are outstanding now or that have been heard already by your court during your administration are going to be finished by you, or are they going to be going to Chief Justice for his oversight?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Thank you very much for the call, David. That's actually another part of this transitional piece that I hadn't thought of.
Yeah.
When you start, in effect, with one court and conclude with another.
The answer is a little of both. There will be a fair number of cases in which I participated in the argument that will get decided before I actually leave. They'll get decided by the present five. Mm-hmm. Then there'll be a period of time when there'll only be, probably, four members, and they will do one of two things. If they all four agree, the odds are the case will be decided in accordance with their agreement, or if three of them agree rather solidly, mm-hmm. they would be able to issue a final decision. And then there'll be some others where the four were divided, and maybe I was part of a 3-2 mm-hmm. Majority that didn't actually get a decision made because there was this transition. And then they'll handle those cases sort of one case at a time. They'll look at each one, decide should we have this re-argued, should the new justice participate. And when I came, sort of the same thing happened. It was a different environment, but you try to apply the rule of reason to each one, depending on when it was heard, who was there, what's the lineup on the day it has to be decided. Some of them will be decided with a 5-person court, including me. There's still a couple of weeks left when that will happen. And after that, the four and the four plus one will decide on each instance whether the new person should participate, look at the videotape of the oral argument, and cast a vote.
We are talking today with Chief Justice Randall Shepherd. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. We're talking with Chief Justice Randall Shepherd. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com. We are talking today with Chief Justice Randall Shepard, who soon will be retiring. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Travis who's basically saying what your view might be on the right to work bill that just passed. There are some things, obviously, something that might appear before the court you technically can't comment on, and I should say that so that you're not the bad guy here. But
appreciate Travis's inquiry, and I appreciate your observation.
Okay. Well, and I guess I would say, is that a difficult part of the work of being a judge, that there are so many things, you know, everyone in the state for that period when the battle was going on here was talking about right to work. Mm-hmm. But those of you who are on the bench are like the only ones who can't talk about
yes.
it because it might appear before you. Is that a difficult part of the discipline of being a judge?
You get used to it. It takes a while, but it's the least dangerous branch because we don't wade into things, only involved in the things people actually present to us, and we try not to involve ourselves in the broader and rightfully political debate.
When you became Chief Justice and through the much of your tenure, you often said you wanted to hear cases that were specific to the Indiana Constitution, mm-hmm. to see if individual liberty could be expanded under Indiana's Constitution. How successful do you think the court was during your 25 years at doing that?
Well, I think it is a considerable change. Now, the question was not so much you don't start off from the notion that you'll do that to expand the definition of rights, but rather to afford those rights that are in the Constitution, mm-hmm. but it's sort of been pushed to one side. Mm-hmm. This is one, frankly, is one product of the great era of Earl Warren, that mm-hmm. that state constitutions got pushed back into the shadow because so much of the activity was under the federal constitution.
Mm-hmm.
But I was at a conference Thursday and Friday on the question of what people sometimes call civil Gideon,
mm-hmm.
Gideon versus Wainwright, the case of the U.S. Supreme Court, which said states had an obligation to supply mm-hmm. counsel to the indigent who were criminal defendants. Indiana's civil Gideon is decided in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Indiana's Gideon is dated 1854 mm-hmm. Under the Indiana Constitution. So my objective there was to say, let's not forget that the people who founded our state created its own Bill of Rights,
mm-hmm.
and that those are questions that we'll decide one at a time, but we won't pretend like they don't exist.
Okay.
And it doesn't mean necessarily that when you say, I know I have a claim under Article 1, Section 14, doesn't mean you win, but it does mean you get a hearing. Somebody will stop and think about whether you ought to be entitled to win under the Indiana Constitution.
Well, and as a practical matter, though, it wouldn't it be that under the state constitution, it would have to be more expansive because your state can't
yes.
restrict rights.
This is
that,
correct.
So true. How successful do you think that effort was over the years?
I think it would be a rare moment these days when an appellate court cited to the Indiana Constitution wouldn't take the time to think it through. And that'd be my definition. That is to say, a litigant who raises now whether they've won or lost, I'm not sure I could give you a number on that. But it would be unusual that a trial court judge or an appellate court judge, if you teed it up, wouldn't say, "Oh yeah, that might be. You might get a different answer under the Indiana Constitution," and that's a successful venture.
So the pieces are beginning to fit together for me here, and that obviously it was about making the Supreme Court co-equal. To some degree, what you were trying to do was make the Indiana Constitution a relevant document so that mm-hmm. when it got called in, exactly how people interpreted it was less important than the fact that they had to interpret it,
yes,
had to consider it.
Right.
in the 25 years, what remained still to be done? I mean, what was out there that you had hoped to get to someday, and there just wasn't enough time or other battles?
Well, you know, I've been making myself a list. I should, okay. If I'd known you were going to ask that, I'd have brought my list today. But it's a moving target. It's just like the rest of society. Things change and the needs change. I would give you one. Here's a for instance that on the criminal justice side, we are still in the posture where the kind of sentence imposed, the level of investigation of your case that is possible varies depending on which county you live in. Mm-hmm. And it ought not to. There ought to be, and we in fact have been moving in the direction of assuring on a whole host of things. Another example is child support. Used to be, mm-hmm. I'd have guys, obligors, child support obligors, mm-hmm. not all guys, but mostly. Two guys who'd work on the line at Alcoa in Warwick County who'd end up litigating child support in our county, and one would get three times the amount of child support making the same amount of money on the line. Why? Because there was no standard that would be applied that would help even out those differences. And there are a lot of things like that that's changed. And so it has been in criminal justice. The number of cases that are carried by public defenders, for example, and what kind of training do you need to have a public defender, and so on, has changed a lot and is still changing. Still work to do. That's why mm-hmm. I thought of it when I asked your question. That whether your choices are only prison or probation, and by the way, probation is a lot stronger than it was 25 years ago, or whether there are other things like work release and drug courts and court drug and alcohol programs and so on that are better at tailoring the sentence depending on what kind of actual offense you created and what your prior track record is like. Those are the sorts of things that we've started on and still need to move further on.
We are talking with Chief Justice Randall Shepherd. Here on No Limits, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. This is a question I ask often in job interviews when I'm interviewing someone for a position, but I think there's some application here in part because you're living the situation. The question I'll ask is, you know, many, many years from now, when you retire, what do you want people to say about you at the retirement banquet as a sign that you've been successful? In this case, what are the things that people have said about your tenure that have the most meaning to you?
And that you emboldened me to do better.
And who are the folks who tell you that?
Well, now.
You don't have to give me names, but
I think the best thing that a person in leadership, the best thing that can be said about a person who holds a leadership position is that he or she empowers and emboldens all the other players in that system to take some risk and to be ingenious and to figure out how to make it better tomorrow than it is today. That's just it. That's the best thing you can. You often do it. To be sure, you often are the one who puts up your hand and says, "Let's do this."
Yeah.
But you also help make things happen by letting those who are interested in trying something different and new, knowing that they've got somebody who might stand with them, is you get a lot done that way too.
What is the thing that when you look at the court that you take the most personal satisfaction in? In this past 25 years, I know it's a milestone moment, not just for you but for the state. So, to some degree,
well, I'm forced to give you the answers back to our very first question.
Yeah.
The caliber and topic of what's being litigated there, and by the way, it isn't just by good judging; it's by good lawyering and good trial judging. And the fact that the court feels that it, part of its mission is to help all the people, as Scott Newman once said about us, the Supreme Court cares about the cases it never sees, and we do, and that those are the two best I can do for you.
Okay, the other side of that, that coin is, what are there any regrets over the 25 years? Anything you wish you could revisit? Any issue or battle or whatever that you could take another stab at that upon reflection you've decided might be a wiser course, or just because circumstances have changed?
I'm not sure I can lift one up for you.
Okay. Well, I had to ask the question if it comes to you. We have a question from a listener who prefers to remain anonymous, says, I am 59 years old. From my perspective, it seems that our society becomes more and more punitive each year, as in defining more actions as criminal, more likely making crimes felonies rather than misdemeanors, pushing more for incarceration than other penalties, pushing for lengthier prison sentences, and seeking solutions to societal problems more and more through the criminal courts rather than through civil courts or other civil means, reducing the age when teenagers or children can be tried as adults, etc. From your perspective, how has society changed in this regard over the last 30 years? Mm-hmm. And then he closes by saying, thank you for your service to all of us.
Well, I'd say to the listener, there might be reason for taking heart. There are both trends and counter-trends, and he's correct about many of the items that he lifts up. It's also true. Here, just give you as the listener probably knows, Governor Daniels and I and others, Attorney General Zeller, made common cause on a series of proposals about nonviolent felonies and the ways in which those would be classified and the ways in which they'd be sanctioned. That didn't make it through the last General Assembly, but right after the General Assembly closed, the Judiciary and the Department of Correction invited people to a statewide meeting on alternative sentencing, evidence-based sentencing techniques, and we were invited to go over for the lunch. 775 people showed up. Prosecutors, trial judges, defense lawyers, and the spirit in that room was exhilarating. So there is both there's a yin and a yang to this, and I hope the listener, right as he is on many points, might take some heart that there is plenty of good work to be cited as well.
When you look back on this 25 years, and you started as Chief Justice, what do you wish that you know now you had known then about doing the job? And then I'll flip this out to, what's that little piece of advice? There's a tradition where, the President of the United States is supposed to write a note to his or her successor and leave it in the desk. If you had to write a note like that for the next Chief Justice, what recommendations would you make?
I think I might have been a little slow to be tightly organized on the non-casework. It's partly a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is to say, if you engage on things like sentencing and child custody and abused, neglected children, you have to have close up to you, sort of in the office, capable people who will help you administer and act in those areas. And I think I was a little slow to figure that out. Eventually, I managed to build a set of comrades who would help me program myself and use my time effectively. But it's a little hard to see that need until you're actually in the spot.
And I guess I should say, what's next for you? I mean, what are you thinking about doing? What's the next challenge? I know when I talked with you in December, you said you weren't going to retire, that you did not like that word, that baby boomers don't
baby
do
boomer thing. They don't.
Yeah,
do that,
they don't
right.
do that. Yeah. So have you given any thought then to what the next challenge is?
Well, I have, although this business of getting out of office has turned out to be hard work. There are a lot of loose ends and drawers to clean out, not to mention cases to finish up. I expect I will end up with the way I'm starting to think of it is a sort of portfolio of intriguing things where I might join in our project or a board or some effort where I might not have had the time and the staying power given my existing duties, but things that I now can add value to. And that I'm still formulating up, but I've created for myself a list of things that people have called to talk about that seem interesting. So I suspect there'll be not one big thing, but half a dozen or more things in which I'm individually engaged.
Are you looking at, do you see it as somewhat liberating? I mean, we've talked about earlier in the hour that when right to work or any of these other hot button mm-hmm. issues are going on, you're one of the relatively small set of people who's not allowed to talk about it at all to in effect have the gag come off probably would be.
I think of it more in terms of freedom of schedule. On the other hand, I've had the chance to actually impact those by virtue of holding office. So that's a loss. I won't have quite the platform or the capacity for action that I've had. But I'll look at the glass as being half full and hope that there'll be places. And as I look at the list of possibilities, I think there are places where I can add value and do some interesting stuff.
We're almost near the end here, but have you had any regrets since you announced that you were retiring? Any second thoughts and thought, why am I leaving this? This is a pretty good gig.
Hard to articulate, though. As it turns out, I didn't submit my letter of resignation for a while. Perhaps that indicated either simple forgetfulness or some anxiety about the passing of the moment.
Wow. Chief Justice Randall Shepard, I have to thank you very much for spending this time with us. I've really enjoyed talking with you, and please.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure. It's a very great conversation. Thanks for having me.
And I hope when you do settle in that next half dozen or so roles that you're anticipating, you'll come back and talk with us again.
It's a deal.
Sounds good. We actually are going to continue our conversation about the legacy and impact of the Shepherd Court on Thursday when my guests will be Sheila Kennedy and John Krause. Be a good program. Please tune in for that. 1 p.m. at our regular time on Thursday. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for spending this time with us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alsip. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.